But today I'm talking to Frances du Maurier, your author of a new book about the life of an important figure in the nurturing of progressive rock. The book's entitled For Your Love. Good afternoon, Frances, and thank you for coming on to Radio Jackie to talk to me about your book on the life of Giorgio Gomelsky.
Thank you so very much for having me and for giving me a chance to speak about Giorgio and about the book. I really appreciate that.
Well, he was an influential music promoter. And to start with, he was owner, well, not the starter, but one of his many accolades was the owner of the Crawdaddy Club in Richmond, which is obviously very local to Radio Jackie. So can we talk a little bit about the club and its importance as a venue where the Rolling Stones and the Yardbirds cut their musical teeth?
Right. Actually, the place which is known as the Crawdaddy now is the second Crawdaddy. The one that Giorgio first opened was what is called now 1Q Road, which is right across the street from the Richmond train station, and which Giorgio opened in January 1963. And he had a Sunday night event there, a weekly event. And he had a band coming every Sunday night. First, it was the Dave Hunt Band, which I did not know until Giorgio told me about it, that it featured Ray Davies, future Kinks, on guitar. But then the band got stuck one Sunday night in a snowstorm, so Giorgio fired them, and he brought in the Rolling Stones, whom he knew Brian Jones from the year before already at the Marquee. And so they started doing that on Sunday nights. And it was the first time that the Rolling Stones, as the lineup that would conquer the world, had a chance to play anywhere live with Bill Wyman and Charlie Watts, who had just joined the band. And the first concert actually was kind of a disaster because only three paying customers came in. But little by little, word of mouth, advertising, journalists, it became a huge success in this small place. It was so successful, actually, that the owner of the station hotel asked Giorgio to go elsewhere because the commotion was too much for him. And that's when they moved to the athletic grounds, where the second Crawdaddy became more famous. And that's where the Yardbirds actually started.
Yeah. Why did it get its name Crawdaddy? Where did that come from?
It comes from a song by Bo Diddley. The Rolling Stones at the time were playing a lot of Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley material. And when Giorgio saw them on stage doing the Bo Diddley sound, they were doing mostly three songs, one called Pretty Things, and the other was You Can't Judge a Book by Looking at the Cover. But they would end their set with one called Hey Crawdaddy, or known otherwise as Do the Crawdaddy. And Giorgio realized that, unlike other clubs, that song gave a chance to the audience to participate. Most clubs at the time, you would have the band playing to the audience listening very carefully and clapping at the end politely. But with this song, Mick Jagger could throw it out to the audience, and the audience gave it back to him, hey, Crawdaddy, back and forth. And you have to understand, this was a small place. It was meant for maybe 100, maybe 120 at the most, and they would pack up to 150 people in there. So no ventilation, everybody's sweating like crazy. Giorgio's manager standing on a table, gyrating his arms as a windmill to encourage people to go crazy, and the audience going back and forth with the song, Hey Crawdaddy, Hey Crawdaddy. Well, one day, Giorgio was on the phone with a journalist who asked him, so what's the name of that club? And he didn't have one. And he didn't want to say, well, it's the back room at the station hotel, which doesn't sound very sexy. No. So he remembered that song, Crawdaddy, on the spur of the moment. Oh, the Crawdaddy. And that's how the name was given to the club.
That's an incredible story. Thank you for that. What was it like for him managing the Stones, because they were essentially the bad boys of rock, weren't they?
Right. Well, this is a bittersweet story, actually. Giorgio was the de facto manager of the Rolling Stones at the time, from during the winter and early spring of 1963. But he didn't have a contract with them. And Keith Richards actually mentions it in his book, as well as Bill Wyman in their biographies. that Giorgio, well, did everything he could to put them on the map, to encourage them, to advertise. He actually even took them to a studio to record a couple of songs that have been lost in time. And since Giorgio primarily was a filmmaker, he started making like what would have been the first music video. So everything was in his mind. He thought he was going to be the manager forever of this band and working together and finding success together. But his father passed away and he had to go to Switzerland. And when he came back from burying his father in Switzerland, he was in a room with the guys. He wanted to show them the progresses he had made with the video or the little film. And he realizes there's one more guy in the room. And that guy is Andrew Lou Goldham. And Brian Jones tells Giorgio, oh, by the way, this is our new manager. We just signed with him. And Giorgio felt extremely betrayed all the way to the end of his life. And he never forgave Brian Jones for knifing him in the back. And even Keith and Bill Wyman say it in their book that it had not been an elegant way of parting ways with somebody who had helped them so much.
Yeah. So did you know Prince Rupert? He was a band's business and financial advisor between 1968 and 2007. He was known as Rupee the Groupie and supposedly made the band rich. Is that a true story?
I do not know that it is a true story because that, you see, Giorgio and the Rolling Stones parted ways in 1963. That was, I believe, the last time they were together. So whatever happened to the Rolling Stones after that, Andrew Lou Goldham, to tell you the truth, by the way, it was not a mistake on the part of Brian Jones, because for as much as I love Giorgio, Giorgio was not exactly a business person. And all his life, what he was great at was to encourage people to be better, the better person that they could be, to be creative with sounds, with music, with experimentation of all kinds, with new instruments and all that. But when it came to the business side of it, Giorgio was not exactly qualified to be even his own manager. At the end of his life, he could have benefited from having a real manager. So whatever happened after that with Andrew Lou Goldham and Prince Rupert and others showed long-term that the Rolling Stones, or Brian Jones in that case, had not necessarily made a mistake, but the way it was done was a betrayal, period.
Yeah. Anyway, after Stones, he then went on to another iconic band, the Yardbirds, right, the likes of Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, who was born in Wellington, who died recently in January, and Jimmy Page, all iconic musicians. I understand Giorgio is behind Clapton's nickname, Slow Hand. Can you tell me how this nickname evolved?
Right. Well, Eric Clapton, when he played on stage, very often, maybe not often, but every once in a while, would break a string by pushing it too hard on the neck of the guitar to get a really good sound, but pushing it to the extreme that the string could take, and the string would break. And when Eric on stage would change his string, it would take forever. So the audience eventually would start clapping slowly. Okay. Slowly and slowly. And so Giorgio came up with his name. Well, clapping and Clapton anyway. Giorgio came up with his name, calling him Eric Slowhand Clapton.
It's a great story. How different was it managing the Yardbirds from the Stones?
Entirely different, because he got burnt with the Stones and he understood that he had, you know, once bitten, twice shy, he had to do something very different with them. So the first thing he did was to give them a contract. They were paid a weekly salary, and he would produce the recordings, but he would own the masters. So we are going from a handshake now to a guy who learned and did the best he could to protect himself, not to necessarily abuse the guys, not at all, but at least protect himself that he was not going to be axed another time just like that. And so that relationship changed entirely, also because he became the producer of their recordings, and he had a huge influence on that. He really stirred them in ways that they hadn't been before. And also what Giorgio had learned with the Rolling Stones, challenging the crowd to respond with a bold beat, the Yardbirds were a bit different in the way that the music they played. Giorgio used to call the Stones and the Yardbirds a blues band. start with. Yeah. But from the blues, the evolution was different with the Yardbirds in the sense of something called the reverb. So the Stones would be the call and response answer, but with a reverb, it was a matter of slowing down the beat to a crawl almost, and then bringing it back up to an orgasmic beat that would drive people crazy. So it was the same concept of having the crowd response, but on a different level of how to manipulate the beat, actually, to make people even crazier.
Yeah. I understand For Your Love was a song that Clapton wasn't very happy about, was it?
No. Well, Clapton always fancied himself as a blues purist, who I believe is still today. Good for him. But the recordings that the singles that Giorgio produced for them at the beginning did not hit the chart. And so when Giorgio first heard the demo that Graham Gulman, who wrote the song, had made for this song, For Your Love, Giorgio thought it would be an excellent way for the Yardbirds to break out of the purest mold of the blues and maybe give them a chance to establish themselves in a more commercial way that would be more beneficial for all. And when he brought that to the band, he was already creative. From the demo of Graham Gulman, he thought of bringing Brian Auger on keyboards and with a harpsichord that you can hear at the beginning of the song. That was very creative at the time. But Eric Clapton didn't like that. He wanted to play the blues. And he was not that crazy either, Eric, with the rave-up situation, where it was not as well planned from A to Z as the blues that he wanted to play. So it was time for Eric to leave and do better things with his blues plans, like which he did, of course, with John Mayall and the Blues Breakers. And Giorgio tried to keep Eric. He had him in his office for hours one day and tried to tell Eric, well, maybe, you know, you should think of staying and doing better and or different things with the band. But Eric was dead set with his choice and left the band, and out Eric Clapton, in Jeff Beck.
Yeah. I mean, Clapton was a purist. I've seen him on stage playing with Elton John, and Elton John performs all the razzmatazz of Elton John. And Clapton was a complete opposite. You listen to me. This is my music. This is the way I play my guitar. You enjoy me as I am. I'm not going to really perform for you. It's my music. He was a real purist, wasn't he?
Absolutely. And you can hear that as a very good example with John Mayall, because that was really as pure English blues, I would say, as can be, taking the American blues and having, it was very innovative at the time that Eric would have that sound of the guitar and that power with the guitar, the energy that would come out of it. That was very new, and that was typically English. Nobody else was doing that at the time. And from there, he went out to do Cream, and originally he wanted to just do blues, but because of the influence of Jack Bruce and Ginger Baker, the mix of the three of them started to become more an adventure in sounds and in beats and creativity that took Eric a little bit out of the blues, but he always tried to maintain that blues form in it. Actually, I saw Eric play with Delaney and Bonnie in San Francisco when he joined them for a while, and they were really, really based on the American blues. It's an American band, and but they would also have the gospel atmosphere to it. But at some point, everybody left the stage, and Eric Clapton was left alone on stage to play by himself a crossword. And that was absolutely amazing. And that's where Eric shined in a way that nobody else could.
No, absolutely not. So after the Yardbirds, I think life calmed down a little bit for Giorgio. He did a different type of music production, didn't he?
Right. Well, after the Yardbirds, he decided, actually, he was fired from the Yardbirds. Okay. So that was not exactly a very pleasant thing for him. But he didn't take it badly, because he was also ready to move on. What was happening within the Yardbirds, when Jeff Beck left and Jimmy Page came in, that was another change. And Giorgio was no longer really being appreciated as he had been before. So it was time for him to move on as well. So he decided to start his own record company, Marmalade Records. And he started to look for bands out there. Actually, people were coming to him. And the first one, or one of the first ones, was Tim Packett with Rod Stewart, Brian Auger, Long John Baldry, and Julie Driscoll. And Giorgio recorded some demos of the band live, but it did not materialize into anything. And eventually, what came out of it was Julie Driscoll with Brian Auger and the Trinity, and Giorgio, who was always experimenting with sounds and rhythms and atmospheres in the music and instruments like the mellotron, took them to a studio and recorded This Wheels on Fire. And that's the single that sold the most copies for Giorgio at Marmalade Records, because everything else he was doing was so experimental that it had absolutely no chance of commercial success. Like, for example, The Soft Machine, which is an extraordinary band, was an extraordinary band, and John McLaughlin with his album Extrapolation. All these came first through Giorgio on Marmalade Records. But the company that was financing Giorgio was Polydor Records in Germany, and they told Giorgio, hey, we're giving you money, but you're not bringing in money, because your recordings are not selling well enough. So they stopped the cash register, and Giorgio had to close the company. Very disgusted with the whole thing, after 16 years or something like this in England, then he moved back to France.
Okay. You tell me a little bit about, there's a lot about your friendship with Giorgio, and why your book tells us about his legendary influence on the music scene that we've not heard before. This is a new biography about him. Other people have written about him. Why is your book so different? Obviously, because you had a friendship with him.
Well, if I may say so, to start with, it's the first book period about Giorgio Gomeschi. There have been articles by people who did not really know him and who were well-intentioned. I'm not criticizing anything here, but on the contrary. But Giorgio was always in the background. For example, when I saw the Beatles in 1965 in Paris, the Yardbirds with Jeff Beck were opening for the Beatles. And Giorgio was backstage with the Beatles waiting for the Yardbirds to finish their set. Now, a man is with the Beatles and his band is performing with Jeff Beck on stage. You would think somebody like this would be well known. Well, nobody ever knew about Giorgio Gomeschi, really, except people in the music business who really were interested in the nitty-gritty of who was doing what. And throughout his life, it's been like this. My encounter with him started in January 1981. I met him here in New York. And I met him for reasons which had absolutely nothing to do with the music business. I was producing cable television programs, which in 1980, nobody knew what cable television was or what to do with it. And Giorgio was always ahead of his time to develop new technologies in a way that would free people to communicate around the world freely with each other without government or business interference. That was always what was on his mind, and to put people together and see what happens. So I met him for that, but we realized very quickly that we had a lot of things in common besides the French, my French accent, and he had speaking French fluently. And we became friends. And when I told him that I had written my thesis for my master's at the University of Paris on Jack Kerouac and the Beat Generation, he was really interested in that. And in the spring of 1981, he asked me to write his biography. And I was very, wow. The man who discovered the Rolling Stones is asking me to write his biography. Excuse me, I knew. I was very, very flattered in a way. But quickly, I realized that it was going nowhere, because it was impossible to pin down Giorgio long enough to get him to tell the story from A to Z. You'd start somewhere, you'd go somewhere. I mean, it was very, very difficult to do that. And he didn't like to speak much about his past either. He would give you a little bit here, a little bit there, but not the complete story. What mattered to him was the present and what you're going to do with it to build the future. And so since I realized there was no contract, no definite plan of what to do with a biography, no editor, no publisher, no anything, I let it slide because I thought my friendship with him was more important than getting into arguments about writing his biography back then. We talked about it every once in a while over the 35 years that I knew him, and other people did too, but nobody managed to do it. So when he passed away, a French publisher that I had been working with on articles about rock and roll music told me, Francis, you know Giorgio so well, why don't, or you knew him so well, why don't you write a biography and I'll publish it? So I did it in French first. And also what I did is I asked people who knew him well and that I knew to write a recollection of one or two pages to make it richer and also to have, because Giorgio was telling different things to different people as far as his past lives were concerned. And so having everybody in would make the picture more complete. So once I did that and I sent these people a copy of the book as a gift for me to them, to thank them for their help. They told me, Francis, it's in French. I cannot read French. Why don't you do an English translation?
Of course.
And, well, yes, of course. Of course. But without a publisher, promises or anything, it was going to be a huge work for no money and a lot of time. And I hesitated to tell you the truth at first. And then I realized it was, I had to do it for a lot of reasons, for these people who had helped me, but also like an exorcism for myself with the spirit of Giorgio, and also to do for Giorgio what he had not been able to do for himself. So once I started working on it, it became, up to now, it became a life-consuming story. And here I am speaking to Jackie Kerr now about it. You know, I mean, this is beautiful because it's taking me on a trip that I never expected to be so international, so pleasant, so fun, and what we did with the event in Richmond for the book launch at the Crawdaddy was absolutely extraordinary in my life. And to be on the stage of the Crawdaddy playing my blues harmonica, doing the Crawdaddy at the Crawdaddy is an experience that I will never forget. It's a gift in my life, and I'm very happy I did it.
Oh, I so wish I'd been there. So next time you're over at the Crawdaddy, please tell me, and I'll come along and see you.
But I definitely will, absolutely.
Just briefly, his early life, how easy it was him to make his mark on the music industry, because I believe he was, there's certain stories, was he from Ukraine? Was it from Georgia? I know his family escaped Stalinism and eventually settled in London. How easy was it for him to make his mark on the music industry in those days, in the 60s?
It was not meant to be. It's just circumstances happened. He had nothing to do with music. His father, as you mentioned, he was born in Georgia, in the country of Georgia, and Stalinism was rising. And so his father, who had studied medicine in Switzerland, decided to take the family to Switzerland. That took a while because World War II prevented them from entering Switzerland from Italy. But when he arrived in Switzerland, he had discovered in Italy jazz, American jazz music, records, old records. And he became a fan of that. And as he grew up in Switzerland, he started a trio, a jazz trio, where he was playing drums. He was writing articles in jazz magazines. As a teenager, he produced a jazz concert in Switzerland, which unfortunately was canceled because of rain. But I mean, he did all this with jazz. And his mother and father divorced, and his mother went to England eventually, where she, from England, she would send him music papers because she knew he was a fan of jazz. And when he read jazz in England, trad jazz, he never understood the difference between jazz and trad jazz, which everybody else would have made the same mistake if you were in Switzerland in the early 50s and, you know, no internet, no nothing like this. Trad jazz, traditional jazz, maybe Swiss Armstrong or something like this. So he managed at the age of 21 to raise money from an Italian television station, and he promised them he was going to England with that money to document the jazz scene in England. And when he arrived, to his great dismay, jazz had nothing to do with what he was expecting. He was expecting, you know, John Coltrane, Charlie Parker, the big bands, things like Thelonious Monk, and he finds trad jazz is key form music with Chris Barber and Lenny Dinigan, who were extremely successful back then. But that was not the reason he had come. However, the president of the International Jazz Federation in London, Harold Pendleton, told him, this is what we do, this is what you're going to do. And so he produced and directed this short documentary on Chris Barber. And that's how he started to become involved with the music scene at the Marquee in London, primarily this trad jazz, but also there was a house band called Blues Incorporated that featured Long John Baldry and Alexis Corner and Cyril Davis, Dick Exton Smith, and they would let younger people in to sit in. And so he saw that there was this new music happening with these guys like Brian Jones, Keith Richards, Mick Jagger, eventually Ginger Baker, Jack Bruce. There was another energy. And that energy he also discovered in Hamburg, where he went in 1961 with Chris Barber on a tour. And he arrived in Hamburg, and there were a few clubs in the red light districts where bands were playing. And he realized that the London bands were mostly skiffle, but there were bands coming from Liverpool that were entirely different. And you had Rory Storm and the Hurricanes with Ringo Starr on drums. You had the Beatles with Pete Best on drums and Stu Sutcliffe on bass. And that energy, they were playing the same songs as the Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, or Brian Jones in London, but on a different beat. What they had in common was the energy. And the older guys in London didn't like so much that energy. So Giorgio, just to start something else and give them a chance, discussed it with Harold Pendleton and said, let me have my own weeknight at the Marquee, and I'll do something different with these young guys. And that's how he became involved, just to help them, just to produce different music for these people. And because he was with them, because he gave them a chance, because he was so creative and encouraging and nurturing, that's how he got involved in the music business. And eventually, when he opened the Crawdaddy, having his own place, then that became even bigger. And then the Yardbirds, he produces their music. So he went to London to do film, and he ends up being the manager and producer of what would become the biggest acts of the 60s in England, and that would conquer the world, actually. So there you go.
What an incredible story. So Radio Jackie, we're a 24/7 music station, and we play rock as much as we possibly can. So what would Giorgio say to our listeners about the energy of music? And is there a band today that can emulate or bring forth that change that Stones did, that Yardbirds did today? What would Giorgio say today?
Well, Giorgio would never say anything too complimentary, because he did not want you to sit down and be happy with yourself, satisfied that what you've done is the best that you can do. He would always want you to do better. That's number one. But number two, at Richmond 2 weeks ago, when we had the launch of the book, there was a young band called The Hornets that came through the Basement Door, which is a non-for-profit organization, which is fantastic to help young people develop themselves through music. And that band was playing the Rolling Stones of 1964, the Yardbirds, the times with the eras with Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, and Jimmy Page. They were playing The Who, the songs from their first LP and their first EP. The energy was absolutely incredible, and Giorgio would have loved it. That's what I think. To the point that actually people loved it so much that they were invited to other things after that, and I wish them well. They're absolutely great. But first, they're good players, which these days is hard to see. Because now everybody, one guy at home, 42 tracks, does everything. Everybody's a music genius. But you don't have the spirit of a band. And that's what Giorgio was after, to put people together. And he would not be happy until the rhythm section had cut the basic track with the spirit, the atmosphere that he was looking for. And you cannot do that by yourself at home, with no matter how many tracks you have. So this band, these young guys, are absolutely extraordinary, the Hornets. And I would recommend everybody to pay attention to this rising band because they deserve it. I have no interest financially or otherwise in the band, except that I love them. They're great guys, and Giorgio would have loved that.
Francis, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and thank you so much for coming on to Radio Jackie. It's been absolutely brilliant. I could keep you here for ages, but I'm going to let you go now. Good luck with the book.
I hope that you continue to keep Giorgio's flame alive. It's very important, you know, because his life has been an example of what can be done that most of us are dreaming of. The price to pay can be very high, because if you don't manage to balance the budget, this commercial world we live in is absolutely ruthless. But the other side of the coin is that you cannot get any greater pleasure than producing like he produced events, music, putting people together, see what happens, the creativity. And I believe that's what we're born for more than making money.
I think we'll end it there. And I think it's a very good thing to end on. Thank you so much for coming to talk to me again. And I hope we keep in touch. And
My pleasure. Your enthusiasm
okay. for Giorgio is astounding and very, very contagious. So thank you so much for talking to me.
My pleasure.
Okay, bye for now, Francis.
Goodbye. Take care. Okay.